we have a statement at Capital Mind, because you can't really retire, you can't really stop working, but you work because you want to, not because you have to. That is the retirement concept. A lot of people achieve that over time by two ways. First one is financial independence, which is you make enough money to be able to say to your boss that I don't care about this anymore. And I don't want to do stuff that I don't want to do. And therefore, I'm going to be, you know, if you don't want me to do this, I can leave my job and I'm fine because my financial independence is big enough. But more commonly, what we're seeing is that people just get to these spots where they don't have to worry about the money anymore. So they enjoy the work so much, they continue to work despite all of the constraints that they have at work. And their jobs typically are very satisfying as well. So they can want to continue to work as long as they are. They don't have to worry about the money anymore. So it doesn't really bother them how much they earn.
Hi everyone, I'm your host Siddharth Ahluwalia. Before we dive deep into this week's conversation, I would like to thank our sponsors, Prime Venture Partners. Prime is a high conviction, high support investor backing star teams with differentiated ideas. All partners at Prime work actively with the entrepreneurs post-investment to accelerate building a great company. Prime focuses on building differentiating companies whose solutions are 10x better and are powered by technology and product. Prime is now investing from its fourth fund of $100 million and is often the first institutional investor in category-creating tech startups such as Quizzes, MoneyTap, Neo, and Dozy. To know more about Prime, visit primevp.in. Today, we have with us Deepak Shenoy, founder of Capital Mind, a SEBI-registered wealth management firm, and he's author of MoneyWise, Timeless Lessons on Building Wealth. Welcome, Deepak, to the podcast.
Thanks, Siddharth, and awesome to be on the 100X podcast.
Deepak, would love to know about how you started your own investing journey.
So where I come from is, you know, I was a tech engineer, to be precise. So we're writing code, we're running, I was building my first business at the time, and perhaps early, 1999 is probably when I actually invested my first rupee. But of course, the family has been invested in stocks for the longest time, small, and you know, at the time you didn't have these DMAT accounts, you didn't have all of this, so you got physical certificates. So I did my first investment possibly into a mutual fund in 1999 or 2000 February actually, because that was the peak of the dot-com boom, and that was pretty much when I put my first rupee into mutual funds. I had a little bit of money, I put all of it into mutual funds to see how this whole thing works. And of course, the whole world came crashing down. My investment, which was in a technology fund, fell 80%. But since then, you know, things have been about learning, going direct investing, buying mutual funds, doing quantitative algorithmic investing, left technology to build a fintech company around algorithmic trading in 2007. Actually worked for an algorithmic hedge fund in 2009. And then went on to build Capital Mind toward, which was more data-oriented investing methodology over the long term. So that's been kind of a longest journey shortened into a small, you know, couple of sentences.
And when you realized that it became a full-time passion or full-time profession for you, investing in public markets?
Yeah, 2007 was when I think I said, okay, I'd just got an exit from a company I was in, and I had some money. So I said, okay, why don't we do this full time? My partner Kaushik and I moved to Navi Mumbai from Bangalore to be closer to the action. All the action seemed to be in Bombay. So we moved there. But, you know, 2008 was when, you know, terrible tragedy struck the markets. We were doing fairly well, to be honest. Our algo strategies were actually working quite well. Unfortunately, markets didn't allow us to pick up more capital or scale at the time. Nobody was interested in stock markets at all. If you asked anybody in the December of 2008 if you wanted stock markets, nobody really cared. So, but I was interested enough to say this is going to be a full-time passion for me, a full-time job for me. So I went on worked with an algo trading fund, left it to do something in financial education, which eventually morphed into what is now Capital Mind. Primarily, research plus education plus enrichment plus entertainment all in one as a platform for people to either do it themselves or to, for us to do it for them. As part of the PMS, we can invest our customers' money. So it's kind of an evolution there, but it was largely full-time for me since 2007.
And since your journey, right, you have built wealth for yourself and wealth for many number of clients. If you can start from basic, what is it required to build your first CR in wealth, in public stocks or in assets, as you say?
So in general, and I write this in my book also, your first rupees will always come from the amount you earn from your job, from your work and so on. It's very rare that you find a person who says, I'll put some 5 lakhs in, it becomes 20x, it becomes a crore. That is hardly the case. Most of the people who earn their first crore, million, whatever, earn it from the job that they do. And that is possibly how most people will eventually build wealth. So you build your first crore through your job, through your savings. Your savings can grow, but the incremental amount that you will earn from the job and savings is higher than how much of a return you get from the money you put in. So a person saving 1 lakh a month will add 12 lakhs to his savings every year. If he starts off with a saving of 50 lakhs, he has to make a 25% return. 24% return just to make that 12 lakhs. And he won't. Most likely 24% returns are obscene. They're not going to happen to everybody. You'll make 10, 12, 13%. And therefore, what you add to your portfolio at a 50 lakh level will be another 6 lakhs or 7 lakhs. But your income savings are giving you that 1 lakh extra a month, which is 24%. So you can change these numbers. You can say, okay, I save 50,000 a month, but I have a 25 lakh corpus. No matter how you do it, your first crore will come mostly from the extra money you save every year from your savings, from your income, but not necessarily from your growth. So your second crore or second or third crore will start to come from growth that you see in the portfolios as well. So when you cross the 1 crore or 2 crore number, then the incremental money you're making, even if it's 10%, is probably significant compared to your savings. So that's where you start making your larger sums of money. If you're a trader also, that's an income-based strategy. So you might, their percentage of return does not matter as much as the absolute amount that you earn. So you might be making 300%, but it's limited to maybe 5 or 10 lakhs a year or 15 lakhs a year. And in some cases, it can be much, much higher. It's, trading can scale quite considerably at the 1 or 2 crore levels. That is where I think, people should focus on more for their first crore is just earn the money instead of trying to make it from your returns that on your capital. Beyond that, of course, you can do much more with capital.
And then starting from 1 crore to 10 crore journey, what are the best behavior patterns that you have observed and today which you advise?
So in general, your 10 crores is like achievable for a very, very small set of people who typically do not want to give up their jobs and just want their savings to kind of grow. They will earn this money towards the later part of their life. So if you keep saving over time and time and time, and you will get to that number over a period of maybe 15, 20 years is when that money will come, typically from your from the savings you make and investments you make. The difference can be if you go run a startup, if you join a startup and or found a startup, a sale or a valuation or a secondary from a VC may actually give you enough to be able to generate that 1 crore relatively faster. So it's a leap of faith in a way. The other one is to join a startup or a listed company or any of these companies where the growth from the stock price itself or the price of the stock from your options itself can give you a big leap. From the 2 or 3 crores which you would otherwise have saved to the 10 crore levels. So I think behaviorally, the idea is to maximize those opportunities for the longer gains, build in stock options into wherever you're working, build more savings. But the savings itself is not going to give you this, this sudden jump. It's going to be more linear in nature. Or, you know, people who take risks, for instance, invested early in cryptocurrencies, which suddenly has boomed up right now and hopefully gives them enough capital to reach that 1 crore. So those extreme risks with a small part of portfolio has potentially, a jump into the 10 crore level. But otherwise, you're getting to 10 crores very slowly. It's okay also. It's fine. Everybody does not need to earn 10 crores and need to struggle so much that they try to earn that 10 crore number. Many people are satisfied with a lot lesser, and it gives them great quality of life. I think quality of life is to be aspired for. So if 10 crores is what makes your life great, that's fantastic. If it's 5 crores, it doesn't mean it's any worse for you. It's just that, the way to get there has a quotient, has a part of it as a sudden immediate jump, where you might use options, you might have these extreme risk cases like cryptocurrencies, starting your own company and so on. Or you go slowly, which will mean you'll achieve that target in a longer period of time, but it'll allow you to do your job in a more normal way. So I think the behavioral pattern is largely about how aggressive people are and how well they can take losses. All entrepreneurial activities involve losing money, time, effort, enthusiasm. All of that has a cost, and that, if you're not willing to lose, then I think the slow way is better for you. But if you're more the dynamic kind who says, I don't care, I want the rewards and I'll chase after them, and even if I take some risks, it's fine, then the first way is better. So it's behaviorally, it's different for different people.
Let's focus on financial independence, right? Where our listener doesn't have to work for money, right? He works for his choice, his love for work or passion, right? At what stage you think, right? What does it require to reach there?
So, they call retirement as that. So we have a statement at Capital Mind, because you can't really retire. You can't really stop working, but you work because you want to, not because you have to. That is the retirement concept. A lot of people achieve that over time by two ways. First one is financial independence, which is you make enough money to be able to say to your boss that I don't care about this anymore. And I don't want to do stuff that I don't want to do. And therefore, I'm going to be, if you don't want me to do this, I can leave my job and I'm fine, because my financial independence is big enough. But more commonly, what we're seeing is that people just get to these spots where they don't have to worry about the money anymore. So they enjoy the work so much, they continue to work despite all of the constraints that they have at work. And their jobs typically are very satisfying as well. So they can want to continue to work as long as they are. They don't have to worry about the money anymore. So it doesn't really bother them how much they earn. But the difference between the two is the first set of people actually want something else to do. So they want to do something else, but they're doing this just because it gets them enough money. So that point of financial independence just tips them over, and then they can go do their own thing. Now, as much as I have seen, it largely starts off with a feeling that I need the money. But people who are truly passionate about something don't care. They will let go even earlier. They will find a way to make money in their what they're really passionate about. They take people for walks all across Bangalore or across Bombay just to show people. And it's a fee, but they take you through the history of the city in a way, and different kinds of things. There are people who have given up city jobs to run a farm. Not as rewarding financially perhaps, but they're very happy where they are, and they find that quality of life is more important to them than the finances, and they're also farming, so bringing new techniques to farming, they're able to earn more money or enough money to be able to take care of themselves. So that I think that financial independence is often a first thought, saying I can't quit my job because I don't have enough money. But it empowers a lot of people who are sort of passionate. So they might actually think I need to make 5 crores before I need to quit. To quit a little bit earlier, also saying I don't need 5 crores. I can make do with even 1 crore or 50 lakhs or 75 lakhs. But also empowers a set of people who are in lousy relationships, perhaps both emotional, mental or physical. So they end up being able to get out and do something on their own. I've seen this happen more often recently than otherwise.
Deepak, so emotional decisions like buying a house, buying car, or vacations, do they hinder in the process of wealth creation?
Well, they are emotional things, and I think it's important to solve the emotional problems at some point in life. So you have to buy a nice car when you want to travel. And I love driving. So, you know, if I mean, there are people who may not find a car very useful. They can just use an Uber or whatever or Ola to travel. But for me, it's important because I like to travel outside, out of the city quite a bit. So, it's important for me, so I'll buy it. House is not as important for me. I don't mind living on rent for a long time because I don't really care. But for other people, it's an emotional decision to buy. You should buy those and solve your emotional problems because that's what money is for. But wealth creation in the longer term is going to be beyond all of this. So you have to spend on these things because they give you emotional satisfaction. But you should also ensure that money is to enhance your journey. It is not to reach a destination saying I'm free financially and all that stuff. You know, like my parents say, or my mother just say, my dad used to say it a long time back, which is that if you don't eat sweets for the longest time, thinking that you'll eat it when you're older, then you get diabetes and then you can't eat sweets. So, you know, you should enjoy your journey. So don't think of these as hindrances on the path of wealth creation, because then wealth creation becomes a goal in and of itself, which is wrong. Wealth creation should be a byproduct of your journey. And if you can't enjoy the journey because you're trying to hoard all your wealth and you're not saving, spending on stuff that makes you happy, then I think you're missing the point. So, building your wealth is less important than, you know, enjoying the process of doing so. Don't do things in excess, but I don't think you should, you know, starve and eat and survive on Maggi just because you want to save that extra 5 rupees so that, you know, you can, I don't know what you'll do with the money, eat more Maggi, I suppose, because that's my thought at least.
Yeah. But is delayed gratification a part of the wealth creation or it doesn't affect it?
Well, it depends on what you want to delayed gratify yourself with. So, for instance, if you're the kind of person who wants to party every Saturday, and then I don't think you'll see a point of delayed gratification, because what will you do then? Not party now and party later? So you have to change your mindset to say, listen, I can't afford this kind of partying, therefore I have to reduce my partying if I have to actually create wealth, because you're actually hindering your wealth creation process by saying I don't save any money by doing these parties every month. But if you earn enough money to be able to save and do parties every month, be my guest. I think that is perfectly fine as long as you're saving enough for your retirement. It's important to save because at some point you're going to need that money and you won't have the earning capacity to do so. So as long as you've kept that aside, that amount of money that can be built in the longer term. And you can start anytime. It doesn't mean you have to start at 25 or 30 or 35. It's just easier if you start earlier. But even if you're 40, you can start and you can build yourself that wealth. But delaying that gratification forever any sort of gratification forever is not a great idea. I haven't not bought a house because of delayed gratification, saying I'll save now and buy a house later. I have not bought a house because I don't know whether this city is where I want to live forever. And it doesn't make sense to keep your, options closed for buying a house. If you buy a house, you get too attached to it and, you know, all the emotional attachments come, which I don't think we want. So when we decide, when we flip the switch, we'll flip the switch. So it's not because we want to delay it just so that we could save money to buy a house.
And On the path of, let's say, getting to X target, for some it may be 1 crore, for some it may be 2 or 5 crore. How much is investing monthly a part of their savings important to it, right? Whether
typically it is important in the sense if you can. So a lot of people have these EMIs which don't allow them to save. So they keep using those EMIs to buy their house or whatever. And then the house is not really a saving for a long term. You're going to all have that house and that's going to be a house you'll have, but that's not going to feed you, you know. So unless you sell it and get the money, and that's not something that you're going to want to do unless you're in a distressed situation. So really, saving is an important part of longer term wealth creation beyond all of these spending things like houses and cars and all that stuff. So where you're going to eventually be will be a eventual result of your savings. That means you can't get to a point where you'll say, listen, I'll somehow make this 1 crore per happen out of the blue. It won't happen as a lottery. It has to be a slow process of saving. Unless you're in the business like we are of actually investing money, where we can actually say we'll turn some money into more money, hopefully over the longer term, and that will result in something. You can outsource that job. You can buy mutual funds. You can buy companies like ours. You can buy stocks. Those are longer term investments. That is the point of saving and then investing it into assets that can give you larger amounts in the longer term. So it's the only way you will get there is by saving. Actually, not the only way. The most likely way you'll get there is by saving. The most unlikely way is by a sudden big, you know, your company gets bought over and you get 1 crore rupees, lottery-ish kind of thing. So that's the only other way you can make the money. Unless, so that's what I was saying. It's like, you know, you got to balance that out. But I think saving is, it's, you can't bet on these lottery kind of events. So therefore, you have to save.
And what have you seen, the saving rates of the individuals, I would say, the most happy, most contented with their financial goals?
So, I mean, we've seen all kinds, to be honest. I've seen people who save 75-80% of their take-home salaries because they don't spend that much. There are people who save less than 5%. But typically, someone who spends a lot and who's contented is already got a huge corpus in place. So they're like, I don't care. I'll spend all the money that I have because I have this built up this 3 or 4 or 5 crore corpus over a long period of time. So that's also fine. But I think it's largely that. How close are you to your financial goal requirements? So for instance, if you're 2 years away, but you've already got 80% of the required corpus that you've decided, and you can decide this fairly easily. We have a tool also called plan.capitalmindwealth.com. So you can actually go there and figure out how much money you need if you want to retire at 60, 50 and all that stuff. So if you've reached that point where, listen, I need 3 crores and I have 2.5 already, then I can actually reduce my savings because over a period of 4 or 5 years, that 2.5 itself will probably grow to 3, you know, just by the nature of inflation it's likely that over 4 or 5 years, I'll get there anyways. So I don't need to save. If I don't have anything, if I have a lot lesser, then I have to save more or find more sources of income to be able to bridge that gap. So I think contentment is that, is saying, am I on the track, right track? And am I at the right kind of distance away from my goal so I'll actually be able to make it? The more closer you are to that and more on track you are, so for instance, if I want to go from Bangalore to Mysore, it's 140 kilometers. I know it's going to take roughly 2 hours. If in 1.5 hours, I've only done 30 kilometers, I'm in trouble. I'm not going to get there in another half an hour, no matter what the traffic situation. But if I'm only 30 kilometers away and it's 1.5 hours past, I know that possibly I can make it. You know, it's 60 kilometer per hour possible. I can get there in 30 minutes. So I don't have to drive too fast now. So what happens typically is people find their way behind and then they try to take extreme risks. And that's a big problem because if you take extreme risks, you could have extreme losses. More likely you'll have extreme losses. So you won't get there, and then that will make life even more miserable because you have now lost the capital that you already have saved by taking those extreme risks. So that is something where, you know, you would either say, I can't retire 5 years later. Let me retire 10 years later. Or I can't do it with this kind of income. Let me try and increase my income, get a better job, take a second job and so on. So these are things that I think one needs to course correct over the course of their financial lives. And people who need lesser and lesser course correction are usually the most happy.
So though you are saying the people who take less of extreme steps are the most happy?
Well, typically all progress is a result of unhappiness. So people who take extreme risks tend to make the most progress in society. That's because they are inherently unhappy about the status quo. So, you know, happiness and progress are sometimes not compatible.
And Deepak, is investing, you think, in 2021 becoming mainstream for general public? Because, you know, the signals that we see, right? For example, during IPL and T20 World Cup, 90% of the ads are about investing platforms or brokerages like Upstox, CoinSwitch, and others.
So what's happened right now is a surplus of money that's making its way into investing into such companies. They are using the money to buy into IPL ads. They're probably driving up the price of IPL ads so much that the traditional advertisers, the car manufacturers or the FMCG companies, are no longer advertising on the IPL because the prices are too high, because these people have come in. And they've come in with deep, deep pockets. So you see Cred, you see Upstox, all of them have raised significant rounds of capital in the recent past, and that capital is going towards ads. Now, this is not very different from the US. You had a period in the US when such companies were the only ones advertising in the Super Bowl. That's because they had extreme amounts of capital and they were able to finance those large. Even now, if you see what's on the T-shirts of the Indian team in the T20, it's got Byju's on it, or it's got Paytm on it. Or these are all startups. Earlier there used to be Seat and all that. Even now, Seat makes bats and MRF makes bats, and that's what shows on the front of bats. I'm telling you, tomorrow a startup will start making bats and you will see some Paytm or something like that in that. It's a function of money that has been pumped in into these spaces. It is not because investing is mainstream that they're doing this. It's because they've been able to raise capital on the back of the fact that India is relatively underserved in terms of number of businesses that have brought people into investing. The scale and the landscape of it has changed quite dramatically in the last 1 year. People are hoping that with the pumping of money, more great things will happen and more people will continue to invest. This is typically a bull market. If there was a 30% correction in the market, none of those ads would be visible because none of them would be able to raise capital, and these people would go back down. So I think, you know, it's a function of where we are in the market run. I don't think that this is a fundamental change in the dynamics of advertising. But I think, you know, from a people perspective, we're still very, very early, and possibly a lot more big and bad things also will happen before we actually mature as a society. So right now, everybody's chasing those 50% per month kind of gains you can see in crypto. That's because nobody has seen a 90%, 100%. I mean, many people have, but it's not widespread enough to have scared the whole bandwagon off the table. When that happens, you'll see the crypto ads vanish also. So I think the fact is that speculation is always, you know, big in India. So whether you speculate with real estate, whether you speculate with stocks, whether you speculate with crypto, there will always be a need to, you know, fight those guys. If gambling was legal, India would see only gambling ads.
Deepak, you have seen two bursts or crashes in the market. One was the 99.com. Second one was 2008. What are some of the signals, if you had identified from those times, right, which can apply to current market? So do you see commonalities between the two?
Yeah, of course. I mean, you have the same kind of euphoria now that you used to have then. So now is better. I mean, last year we were wondering whether that euphoria is similar, but now I think it's much more likely to be similar to 2008 and 1999 compared to maybe 2020 or 2017 or something like that, where markets were going up, but we weren't seeing the same kind of euphoria. So now, you know, if you go and talk to people about stock markets, he'll probably tell you five stocks he's invested in that made 20%, or crypto or something like that. So that fervor and that euphoria and that feeling that I cannot lose, that is the one that's very common. So it's mostly behavioral. It's mostly people who are taking out money from relatively safe assets to invest in markets that drives this kind of behavior, and is driving it right now. So very similar things, but like 2008 stretched a lot. 1999 stretched a lot. It went, when people said it was extremely overvalued, it went another 30% higher than that before crashing. The same thing in 2007, when people said it was too much, the markets went 25% in 3 or 4 months before it crashed. So it could be likely that the markets are overvalued right now, but it's also equally likely markets continue to go up another 30% before they crash, because that's the nature of such markets, that they don't give you this, you know, oh, it is overvalued now, let's crash. You know, it doesn't happen like that. So you cannot bet on the lack of rationality, falling apart at any given point in time. All I can say is you got to keep your feet in, and you got to keep enough asset allocation in so that you can benefit from both the upside and also protect yourself from a little bit of downside by having money in other asset classes.
So, do you advise your clients to spread assets across multiple asset classes like gold?
Well, not gold, stocks. But yes, we do talk about Indian stocks, international stocks, Indian fixed income, and fixed income of various types, shorter term and longer term. So if you spread across those, then you should be fine over the longer term. And the amount each will be dependent on each person. So some person may have a 10% allocation to international stocks, 70% to Indian stocks, and 20% to fixed income. Some person may have 50% fixed income, 50% everything else. So it depends on a person's risk-taking ability, the desire for risk, which is their appetite, how much they can take, and secondly, their financial ability to take risk. That means how close are you to the point where you need the liquidity? Do you have a large amount of debt that will cripple you from taking large amounts of risk? So these kinds of factors, if you add together, you'll come out with a number that says, well, roughly you can take 60% equity, 40% fixed income kind of risk. Another person can say, listen, everything else is taken care of. You can take 100% equity. It doesn't matter. So all of these things together, I think, add up to where you should be. And therefore, I always tell people spread across asset class. Many people have it. You have PPF, for instance, or PF. Your PF is typically a fixed income instrument for the most part. So that's already giving you a debt allocation for your longer term. You can then, therefore, whatever beyond you have as savings, that can go into equity. And you'll still be maybe 70-30 or 60-40 because your PF has kind of added up to so much all these years.
And in today's market, you see, I think in 2021 has seen the highest number of Indian companies go public. Is it also a signal of the capacity of retail investors to buy, or is it a signal of this is the best time to go public? You might not never find a chance again in the next 3-4 years.
Mostly it's called the Chipkao movement. Okay, so it's when you can, you do. That's the way the investment bankers think. That boss, they are putting money. They have put, I don't know, Nykaa got 80 times oversubscribed. It was valued, I think, more than 40% higher than what it was valued in February of this year. Yeah. And relatively speaking, you know, this is froth. So in froth, you can price anything in any, you know, people buy diamonds at whatever price. What is the price of a diamond? It means nothing. Its price is what you can tell me about, because the industrial usage of a diamond is nothing. It can be used to cut glass or a few things. But other than that, there's no use of it. And I won't pay like, you know, $6 million for a diamond. But there are people who do, like art, like crypto. There is no inherent use of anything of that sort, but you price it according to what another person wants to buy it at. So that's what's happening in stock markets right now. The inherent value will be visible over time. Some of these will be grossly underpriced, even though at these prices, and some of them will be grossly overpriced because people have expected too much of them, and those expectations were too high. So as a balance or a counter between the two, I think, you know, markets right now are allowing a lot more froth than they used to. Earlier, 2 or 3 years earlier, you wouldn't have been able to do these issues at all.
And can you advise tools to our listeners on how to find undervalued assets, right, or studies or books in your experience?
So, I mean, I think firstly, what I'm saying is not advice, because I think advice, the word has a specific regulatory nature to it. Advice is always personal, one-on-one. That means if I'm advising you, it's based on your situation. So this is more generic gyan, if you may.
Yeah.
So your recommendation to people when they start looking for value in companies is they typically look at how much as a multiple of earnings that a company can give you. And a growth that the company can give you. So if a company is in a very fast growing sector, technology, Nykaa, for instance, for all its thing, it, forget the valuation that it's at right now, but it's in a phenomenally fast growing market. That market involves bringing all of India to be able to access great cosmetics, which I think in general is a very big commodity, although it's not just a commodity, there are lots of brands, it's a very fragmented market. There are people who want it delivered home so they could change, test, try, all that stuff. There is a tremendous market in there which the current businesses aren't storing. So when you look at a company like that, you're not going to look at its current earning potential alone. You're going to look at potentially how big the market can grow and how much this company can grab of that much larger market. Whereas if you look at a market like the market for noodles, there is a Maggi, there is a few other people, very difficult to get in because building a brand over here takes a long time. There's a massive distribution effort involved because to go to remote parts of the city, you got to have people willing to carry your brand of noodles to that part of the city. And they'll be like, why should I carry yours when I have so much capacity? I'll just carry Maggi. So this is the kind of brand advantages that a current incumbent player will have. And the fear of competition is relatively lower. So you're going to value such a brand very differently from one of these new found larger market brands. Both of them may have value because in one case, the market, if you look at it, I'll give you an example. IRCTC, when it came out with an IPO, they said it's a 3,000 crore company. This sounds a little expensive. Today, it's a 90,000 crore company. Well, today you could still say it's overvalued, but 90,000 crores is a fairly large number compared to 3,000 crores when it listed. And same with DMart. I think DMart, of course, is valued much higher, but when it came out, it was 300 rupees per share. Now it's 4,500 rupees per share in a matter of 2.5 years. What changed? It was expensive then too. The landscape of the retail market has changed. This has survived a pandemic. They had some very interesting things on offer. So there are value points in each company's life that as more information comes, you might find that, oh, it was expensive earlier because I didn't know X. And now that I know X, this sounds cheap. I think that very generically put, you should look at how a company is going to be 10 years from now. And therefore, where it is today, although it may look expensive today, the 10 years later picture could be a dramatically higher part of this universe. It applied to Amazon, Facebook, Google, Tesla. Tesla, you know, Elon Musk is now the richest man in the world. But, you know, 5 years ago, people said Tesla would become bankrupt. Because there's so many challenges where it, you know, about cars, about delivery, I can't deliver, this car is not as good. All that stuff got wiped out because of the execution of this company. And over time, they've built SpaceX also. So betting on a company's future is not a one-time process. It's something that you do over a period of long time. So you're saying, okay, I want this and this and this to happen. If you can't do that, then I think best is to go with mutual funds. Let them go find undervalued assets. So people like us who are running PMSs, which require a larger capital to start with when you invest. But there are people whose job it is to try and find that bridge between value and growth. And who will actually purchase those assets. So there are no easy tips for this. But I would say just look at the landscape of where everything is going to be 5 or 10 years from now. Rather than, you don't need to be exact. You need to be more worried about whether this can scale or not.
And let's say if you have to evaluate putting your client's money into one of those companies, coming IPOs. So is future growth the only metric that you are going to look at?
One thing is the only process that you have now is future growth because all the past data they would have dressed up to make it look good, right? So you may know today that, you know, there's this kind of we've done so much in profit and all that stuff, but almost all IPOs come to you when the books have been dressed up already. So the past is not very relevant to it. So all of it is going to be about how this company is going to be in the future. Now, to have guessed that DMart could have been valued at 150 or 200 or 300,000 crores, when you started off with a valuation of say 20 or 25 or 30,000 crores for this company, the vision would have been to say DMart's going to become this big, the Indian retail market is going to go to this size. Therefore, of that bigger size, I have a small percentage that is being held by accountable by a company like this, and they have profit-making opportunities in X, Y, Z, and therefore I can give this company, an investment right now. However, most investments don't happen like I will invest now and forget forever. Of course, some happen by nature because people get very disappointed. They don't look at their investments. But a large amount of investments are follow-on, right? You invest 10 rupees today, then you'll invest 15 rupees once that company starts showing some progress, then 25 rupees when something else happens, and so on. So those that progression is what brings you the longer-term focus. So building a vision into how these companies will grow and then chalking yourself an investment path saying, listen, when they do this, so for instance, let's say there's a company that has a payments bank today. You know that payments bank are not very profitable, but they can apply in the future to become a small finance bank. That allows them to lend money and earn much more money than what they're earning as a payments bank. So you might say, I'll invest some 10 rupees today, but when it applies to become a payments small finance bank and kind of proves my theory right, is when I'll invest another 15 rupees. And then when they start making profits from this business and start showing me their NPAs and how they're lending and using tech to lend, I will add another 20 rupees. So that's the way you want to think of any of these startups. And you want to invest in a lot of them, not just one or two. Because if you concentrate your bets, the landscape can change very dramatically against you. So you want to make large number of smaller bets rather than small number of concentrated bets.
Got it. And Deepak, in your upcoming book, which is about to be released on 23rd November, MoneyWise, what are 3 to 5 frameworks that you can highlight for our listeners right now that they're going to learn from the book on wealth creation?
Yeah, so I think from what I've written in the book, it starts off with a journey that says, well, I'll tell you, behavior, investing is largely about behavior. When I say, I could give you this funda that says, invest every month like this, and you'll get there. That's the traditional form. It's more gyan giving, I'm telling you and all that. But you're telling me, Deepak, yaar, this all is fine, but I'm getting some, 1 lakh and 2 lakh. But my neighbor, he put 1 lakh rupees into some Tata Motors and it became 5 lakhs in like 3 months. How can I do that also? So I've tried to address that. So behaviorally investing in the longer term is always a challenge because you always find that, oh, yaar, itna kar diya, this market is not moving. What is the point? And my neighbor is investing in crypto. My friend is invested in this. He has bought some real estate property. Should I just take off all my money from here and put it there? This is the kind of thought process you want to avoid. So largely the behavioral challenge is to say, okay, you got to have a broad context. Create yourself a sandbox that allows you to invest in all these 5 lakh, 10 lakh, those 5x, 10x kind of opportunities where you will invest smaller amounts of money, but you'll be happy that you invested that small amount of money and it become 5x. And if you lose also, it's not a big deal. So you create a sandbox for your behavioral excesses, which is normal parts of the market. Keep your regular investments going in parallel. That allows you to participate in the longer term. And how you want to participate is also a very important thing. So whether you want to participate in a mutual fund equity kind of approach, a mutual fund fixed income kind of approach, a fixed deposit kind of approach, or a direct I will buy stocks myself kind of approach. These are 4 or 5 different ways you can invest in the market. You can buy gold. You can buy an ETF that invests in gold. The instruments are different, but how you allocate between these different styles of investing is something that I kind of explore saying, listen, mutual funds are good for X. Within mutual funds, there's something called index funds, where you might find more peace of mind if you're a long-term investor because you don't have to worry about which fund manager is better versus something else. Then you have something called direct stock investing where you choose stocks yourself. This puts you into a higher grade now because now you're going to have to do more work in order to do the same investing. But hopefully those for that more work, you get better returns as well. And then you have the other forms. So for instance, I talk about all the time saying focus on income. So the more income that you can make, the more you can eventually invest in less complicated things so that you can achieve the same goal. But so if the book takes you through a journey of all of this, including the stocks, the mutual funds, the various kinds of scams that have happened in the mutual fund and stock area, that allows you to appreciate when over speculation has led to extreme situations in the market. And that over speculation can be, there was a time when teak plantations were the vogue. You bought a share of a teak plantation and they would build the teak trees, grow it for 20 years. When the teak grows big, they will make a big amount of money and so on. This entire thing was, you know, about 80% of it was scams. So those scammy companies took away the money of so many people that people got disappointed. So it's important to analyze historical excesses in the mind of how things are currently. If somebody comes and tells you, there's this new crypto coin that's going up 10% every day, you should be suspicious more than you should be rejoicing. Because if you're not an insider, not a person who knows this industry deeply, then you're likely going to lose all your money if you put it into such a business. So I think the book kind of takes you through all of that, the journey of an investor and the scams that have happened. In a part of the book I called Suckered, that will tell you how all of this comes together. Hopefully it gives you an insight and helps you invest, but mostly I think it's going to help you build a canvas on what you are and therefore how you should invest, rather than me giving generic advice.
Thank you so much, Deepak. It's been a very insightful conversation. I wish we could do it more.